So why don't we begin, before we begin the talk, just making sure we are clear about the practices that we have referred to this morning, the practices of mindfulness of the body, in the body, the practices of mindfulness of the breath, the in-breath and the out-breath, the body breathing, mindfulness of sitting, mindfulness of walking, mindfulness of concentration, lack of concentration, what to do when there's lack of concentration or distraction. So again, we have people who have been practicing a while and beginners here, doesn't matter. Any questions just about the practices that we have done since this morning, since we began? Anything not clear about how to practice? Please don't be shy. If it's not clear how to deal with this mind and how to practice mindfulness of the body, breath, when sitting and walking, please ask a question. If there are no questions, then I will go into the assumption that everyone here is an expert. Yes. So the question is, what happens when we are uncomfortable? Do we keep moving around to find that place of comfort? Or do we just be mindful that we are uncomfortable? Well, again, it depends what we're practicing. If we're practicing the practice of being comfortable, then we'll keep moving around until we find that place of comfort, right? If we are practicing the practice of just being mindful of, then that's a little different orientation, isn't it? We obviously are not seeking discomfort. That would not be healthy. So we are trying to take a posture, especially like we come to a day of mindfulness like this, formal practice, 30-minute rounds. So obviously we would want to take a posture that we are somewhat comfortable in, right? So please, this is not the place to up your game, you know. Try it out in the full lotus for 30 minutes. That probably should do at home, So again, I would say take a posture that is comfortable. If you're not comfortable, then in a seated posture, and you can look around, see many varieties of seated posture, but it's better to sit in a chair. But having said that, since we are not, most of us, used to sitting for 30 minutes without moving, probably either in a chair or on a cushion, we can imagine that there will be some degree of discomfort. I say discomfort as opposed to excruciating pain. Okay, excruciating pain is a signal from our body, you know, that it's in distress. Discomfort is not that, is it? Being uncomfortable is not that. And so when I said, what is our practice comfort? Or is our practice being mindful and developing that capacity? I think that is significant. Because I think most people in our society, because of the nature of our society, and the nature of comfort and growing up with comfort, or if we grew up with discomfort, wanting to find comfort, being comfortable is a very predominant aspiration for most people. We want to be comfortable. We want to be comfortable in our homes. We want to be comfortable. We just want to be comfortable. So if our intention is to be comfortable in life, that means what? Because we live, because in a world of relativity, the desire for one thing always means a desire not to experience the opposite. See, we're stuck with it. See, if we're seeking comfort, then discomfort is aversive, isn't it? We don't like discomfort. And it's not just being uncomfortable in our physical bodies, which we don't like, right? I mean, we know that it's very, obvious in our, when we are, when we have a headache, we want to do what? Get rid of it. When we have a little upset stomach, we want to do what? Get rid of it. You know, so that is our modus operandi, both in our bodies and especially in our minds. When we are experiencing an unpleasant mind state, an uncomfortable mind state, what do we want to do? What? Get rid of it. Yeah. We don't like, because it's making us uncomfortable. Right? And so rather than, and again, we'll be talking about mindfulness of the mind today, rather than practicing mindfulness, we simply, what can I do? Can I take something? Can I do something? Can I distract myself? Anything but what? Experience that in this moment I am uncomfortable. And that uncomfortable could be, an afflictive emotion. I'm sad, I'm angry, I'm resentful, I'm hurt, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Or it could just be simply, I'm bored. You know, we experience boredom, especially in our society, as an uncomfortable mind state. You know, nothing going on. Got to do something. This is uncomfortable. So it's kind of bigger, as you can see, right? And so it really just depends. I mean, I would say if we're talking just uncomfortableness in the body, you know, there's a little uncomfortable sensation in the knees or the back, you know, but it's not, you know, you don't have a chronic physical problem in your spine or your knees. Or if you're not, experiencing excruciating pain, then a lot of times all we're experiencing is uncomfortableness in the body that comes from taking a posture that we're not used to doing for any length of time. So there'll bound to be uncomfortableness. So in that case, I certainly would recommend being just present to it. There's a lot to be said in the tradition of learning to be present to sensations as sensations. Even to be present to an uncomfortable sensation as an uncomfortable sensation. And just, just be that. Without making a story, right? Because I would imagine when you are uncomfortable, it's not just simply a sensation in your body, you're also telling yourself what? What? Because I don't like it. You see, it's interesting. I mean, if I said to you, is your body in such excruciating experience that it's just begging you to move? No. It's interesting. What is it that's uncomfortable? You see, what is it that says, I don't like this? So if we are practicing a path of some sort of self-awareness, we're interested in that. I mean, what is it that doesn't like this sensation in the body that's somewhat uncomfortable? The body is not screaming out for change, is it? What is this voice that you hear that says, I don't like this, change it, do something? All right, what is this command you're receiving from central headquarters? right? Do something immediately. Find a comfortable posture. You see, it's just very interesting. So if we're practicing as a path of self-awareness, there's interest and curiosity about this voice that is always telling us to move away from uncomfortableness. Because it is the same voice that is moving us not just in the body, but it's also moving us throughout our lives, right? And so that is something rather than always obeying, always listening to, always running, you know, running away from uncomfortableness. You know, is there really something to be, you know, that really is so bad that I need to, that I can't tolerate this? That's sort of like that, right? This is intolerable. Isn't that the voice? This is intolerable. We gotta, but it's not intolerable. Now you know it, right? But back when you were in it, it was telling you what? Tainted. It's just intolerable. Can't take this another moment. But of course, now that you look back in it, you realize that wasn't true, was it? So, false information, false perception. And we want to kind of just be mindful of that. We'll be talking about that today. So yeah, I think it's good to see our life on the cushion as an opportunity to experiment, to learn about ourselves and our reactivity. Is that clear? Does that, okay. Other questions just about mindfulness of the body, mindfulness of the breath, sitting and walking. Everybody else is clear. Good. They're good, that's okay.
Does that apply to sleepiness too? I'm not used to sitting for this long. So about 20 minutes in, I start to get really sleepy. So I'm also resisting comfort because when I'm getting too comfortable, then I'm getting sleepy. Yeah. And what I'd like to do is actually just, you know, lie down and sleep. But
yeah.
I'm fighting the sleepiness.
Right. So that is an interesting point you make about sleepiness, and that sometimes if there is a little discomfort in the body, it can keep you a little awake. So that's, all of a sudden, discomfort is a positive thing if your goal is to stay awake. So it's interesting, and I would certainly say I understand that one. So again, sleepiness, it's very interesting. You know, if you are sleep deprived, you know what I'm saying? You're really sleep deprived, then there may be a reason for your sleepiness. But oftentimes that's not the reason. Yeah, the reason is often that we are not used to maintaining an alert, aware mind by itself. You see? We're used to maintaining our alertness by mental activity or physical activity, right? And so we notice that as soon as I, you know, like you say, I mean, did you get a decent night's sleep last night? Yeah, so I mean, you can check it out. You go, no, there's no reason. And if you were doing something else, you may not be yearning to lay down at this time of the day, right? So it's interesting that, you know, so that's again, that's your curiosity about, this is about your learning about your mind. Is that, well, that's interesting, you know? So then we may come to the conclusion that the sleepiness is kind of a withdrawal from our addiction to stimulation, you see? Like, you know, oh, nothing's going on, right? Nothing to focus on, nothing to do. Oh, sleep. You see, it's kind of interesting, isn't it? When we look at it, see, that's often what's going on. It's you know, the mind is not being stimulated in its usual way. It doesn't, you know, doesn't know what to do, so it goes, oh, maybe this means it's time to go to bed, right? It's kind of, that's its conditioning. Must be bedtime, right? So at, you know, 10:30 in the morning, all you want to do is lay down. So we know that's not really true, is it? So again, we realize that, and in meditation, you know, going back thousands of years, there's lots of, you know, cautions about kind of these two dangers in learning how to meditate. One is, or these are kind of things that get in the way, obstacles. One is the excitable mind, you know, it's very busy, it's excitable, it's, you know, active. And the other is the mind of kind of sleepiness, and it's called sloth and torpor. We don't use those words anymore, but that's kind of the traditional word, sloth and torpor. Your mind has been taken over by sloth and torpor, right? So again, you know, we want to find that middle ground, right? You know, we want to learn, can I just on my own from the inside generate a mind that is clear, that is awake, that is energetic, that comes from the inside? You see, which is not something we're used to. We're used to always generating that by the stimulating of activity or what? Or we, you know, drink coffee or other ways we have of kind of, you know, generating that wakeful mind. But we're not used to generating it on our own. And so again, that's another kind of learning, like the uncomfortable, you know, how can I learn to generate a mind that has energy, that is clear, that is awake, but doesn't have anything excitable to stimulate it? You see, and that's what the mind is often looking for. So how do you do that? Yeah, exactly. For those, she went, I don't know. Good. We don't know, so that's a good place to begin. But obviously, we'll be talking about that today. But I would say just in terms of specifically the meditation, whatever meditation we're doing is, you know, is there energy behind it? You know, am I interested in? Am I curious about what I'm doing? Right? Am I interested in learning how to concentrate my mind? Am I really interested? Is there energy behind this desire to be more mindful? You know, because that's an internally generated energy. It's not an externally. And so we're not used to going, oh, I gotta begin, you know. You see, it's a learning curve. It's like, how do I begin to generate energy from the inside? You see, that's not dependent on what's going on around me. Right? Because again, if you were there sleepy like that, and all of a sudden somebody said, hey, you want to go out and do this? You want to go out and do that? You'd be what? Yeah, let's go. Right? So it's kind of interesting, but how we can just easily, you know, the mind goes, oh yeah. So this is a little different, can you see? And so you want to, I won't talk about it, but again, it's that, you know, it's we want to begin to understand that there are energies within the mind that we can cultivate that are not dependent on externals. And that's a lot about, you know, spiritual life, meditative practice, is kind of having stuff going on inside you that is under, we could say, your control, that is not dependent on externalities. Okay, so again, like you say, you're a beginner, and so it's good to notice these things, you see. It's a learning curve. It's not like, oh, I'm just here to follow my breath. I'm here to follow my breath, but on learning about following my breath, I'm going to learn a lot about me. Right? I'm going to learn a lot about a human being. I'm going to learn about attachment to comfort, aversion to discomfort. And you're going to learn about yourself, you see? And how easily, how you don't like to be uncomfortable. And how often that disturbs you or causes you to act in ways that you really don't need to, right? And you're also going to learn about your mind and how it traditionally energizes itself, right? And how often that energizing is by externals, deadlines, things to do, right? You see, or artificial stimulants, right? And can I learn to know that I can mine these energies, because they are energies of the mind, right? I mean, even if you get interested in something and go, oh, I'm going to go do that, well, the energy to do that is coming from within you. The stimulation is coming from outside you, right? But can I learn to stimulate myself in a certain way? Okay, so it's a learning process. So you're kind of curious about her, and you kind of, well, that's interesting. You see, that's interesting. That's interesting, you know. Lack of stimulation, sleep. You see what I'm saying? So you want to not just take this experience like as kind of learning things like a kind of, you know, mindfulness dogma or anything, but you want to use it to learn about yourself, your own energies, your own mind. Is that clear? Good. Any other questions just about the practices? Yes.
The smile, the slight smile that you cultivate.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about that?
I didn't say anything about it. How did you know we... Yeah.
You noticed that before,
yeah. Yeah, so that's good. So she's talking about what we call the half smile, okay, as a practice. Most Buddhas, you'll notice, are not like this. They have a kind of sweet smile on their face. It's not a happy, happy laugh. It's just a little bit of we call it a half smile. And again, it can be something that can be cultivated. You just notice, if everybody nobody can see you, I'm the only one can see you. If you just put a half smile on your face, just try it. No matter what you're feeling, just put a little half, kind of just. Can you feel what that feels like when you do that? How does that feel? I mean, what do you notice when you put a half smile on your face? You lighten up. Right? Is that what you lighten up? I mean, it's kind of an interesting thing, because oftentimes we don't realize that we carry around a kind of seriousness, or, you know, because we're always concerned about something, right? Always got something on our minds, right? And that produces a kind of frowning or serious kind of quality in our body that we don't even know, right? So the cultivation of the half smile in the Thich Nhat Hanh tradition is actually a practice to be cultivated. You know, not just when we're sitting, but also when we're going about the world. Because it almost immediately lightens us up, right? And we do need to be lightened up. Again, not by, you know, watching the Comedy Channel, you see? Right, not by watching funny YouTube videos. See, that's how we lighten up. But that's, again, all being generated by something coming from the outside. We want to know that we can generate, you know, this kind of lighter mind state from the inside simply by putting a half smile. But to me, the half smile is even as a kind of... In Buddhism, there's this word mudra. It's a Sanskrit word. It sort of has to do with like gesture, physical gesture, a mudra. Like the Buddha has different mudras, different physical manifestations of something inner. And I think the half smile is the mudra of well-being. It is the mudra that everything is okay. It's a significant mudra. And again, it is something that is generated from the inside. Because outwardly, things may not be okay, right? You might be going through, you know, this one may be doing this, and this one may be doing that, or, you know, who knows what's going on in the external world. But it means in this moment, everything is okay. Now, how can everything be okay if there's all kinds of stuff going on around us? All kind of drama. How can we generate the half smile? Right? What do you think? Why should we do that? What is this inner well-being that can say, even in the midst of whatever's going on around us, whatever drama is going on around us in our life, that in this moment, everything is okay. That's the practice. Yes.
But what, despite the knowledge that there is a great deal of suffering.
Well, what if the world wasn't beautiful? What if you woke up one morning and you were on Nebraska Avenue?
Still beautiful.
Really? You find the Nebraska Avenue beautiful? You do. What's so beautiful about Nebraska Avenue and the people walking up and down there and their suffering? Is that really beautiful?
Well, the sky is above it. There's living things.
What if there wasn't any sky above it? What if it was cloudy and dark? Just a miserable day on Nebraska Avenue.
Cool.
Yeah. It's still too much about externals. The whole thing has gone sour, right? Nancy just had a diagnosis of terminal cancer. That's his wife. Hopefully that doesn't happen. all your kids are just, their lives have all fallen apart. Your new granddaughter is in intensive care. I mean, do you want me to go on and on? You know? All right. Let's just kind of pull it all away, all right? You know? Yeah, you've been dispossessed from your home. You're living on the street on Nebraska Avenue. Found out your health insurance was all canceled. You didn't know it. I mean, do you want me to continue, or is... Tell me when I've reached that point.
No, I could generate.
All right. All right. So this is the depth we want that half smile to come from. That in this moment, with all that, sitting here, breathing in and out, in the calmness of my own body, mind, everything is okay. Okay. That's where the okayness has to come from. And that okayness that is generated from the inside of resting in one's own nature gives us the ability, if that ever came to be, hopefully it will not, that you can be present to it all, right? In calmness and clarity with a state of inner well-being. I mean, that's not easy, right? So it's not easy to be a Buddha, right? So that half smile is very profound. It is not based on anything that's going on around us. It's based on in this moment, no matter what is going on, even within myself, I can generate mindfulness. I can be in touch with a deeper state of well-being within myself that is not conditioned on how things are going in the world, right? So that's the depth we want to get to, which is not that hard, because it is always available to us. But it means be a willingness to put down the dramas of our life, right? To touch a deeper place. That is why we can generate a half smile. So it's many levels of half smile. Is that clear? But we'd like to get it, as our practice deepens, to that point where even in the face of catastrophe after catastrophe, right, in the face of that, we know at the very core of it all, everything is okay. Everything's okay. That's why the Buddha can smile. Faced with the catastrophe of the world, how does he dare to smile? Right? How does he dare to smile with all the horrors that go on in our world? Right? How dare he smile? As Thich Nhat Hanh says, it is because of all that it is our duty to smile. It is our duty to generate well-being. It is our duty to generate the calm, open mind. Does that make sense? I mean, that was a big answer to maybe a simple question. Forgive me. What, the half smile? Yeah, well that's what Thich Nhat Hanh says when he says it is our duty. You know, because of the great suffering of the world, because of the suffering that may be going on around us, because everybody in Andrew's world everything's just fallen apart. How wonderful in the midst of that somebody can manifest well-being. Right? Right? That somebody could say, even in the darkness, everything will be all right. Right? Isn't that what parents say to their children? Right? Yet we have no idea, truly, how things are going to go. So it's everything is going to be all right. It's deeper than that. Is everything's going to be all right because why? When a parent says it to the child, because what? Because I am here with you. So the child can relax and trust. Everything will be all right. But as individuals, we can say everything will be all right because we know a deeper place that life unfolds. Deeper than the ups and downs, the backs and forth of what's going on. And so spiritual life gives us that ability to live from that deeper place in the midst of the ups and downs, backs and forth, successes and failures of daily life, worldly life it's called. That's what a spiritual life is about. Right? It is a life that is not dependent on what's going on in the world. Because the world is what? The world is a fragile thing. Impermanent, always changing, endlessly blown about by the winds of cause and effect. If there are a lot of people in the world making a lot of negative causes, there's going to be a lot of negative winds blowing through it. Is that right? Yeah. When there are more people in the world making positive causes, there will be more positive winds blowing through the world. That is the way, isn't it? How do we deal with it? Get mindfulness, concentration, insight gives us the way to deal with it, right? Gives us the way to deal with uncomfortableness. A lot of things in the world to be uncomfortable about today. You better believe it. Could get worse. Yep, could. What are we going to do? How are we going to be when things become more uncomfortable? Right? If our purpose in life is to be comfortable, we'll find that greater uncomfortability very deeply disturbing, won't we? If our purpose in life is not that, to be comfortable, but to be present and mindful, aware, generate understanding and compassion toward what goes on in the world, then we'll be fine. We'll have more opportunity. Isn't that correct? No. So good. Any other questions? So I wanted to talk today and then practice the rest of the day mindfulness of the mind. You know, the Buddha said when he, and again, for those of you who may be new in our community, for many months now, we have been practicing mindfulness as taught originally by the Buddha in the two suttas or teachings he gave, Full Awareness of the Breath Sutta and the Four Establishments of Mindfulness Sutta. Suttas are these teachings of the Buddha that were written down. And again, before, and those of you who are in the intensive know this, but it's worth repeating, that he teaches mindfulness, the four establishments of mindfulness, in a context. He doesn't just teach mindfulness as a therapeutic intervention in and of itself. Before he talks about mindfulness, he says, there is a wonderful way to help living beings realize purification, overcome directly grief and sorrow and pain and anxiety, travel the right path, and realize nirvana. Okay. Everybody see the context? Big context. Okay. You know. He doesn't say there is a way to to lessen your stress. It's bigger than that. There is a most wonderful way to help living beings realize purification, overcome directly grief and sorrow, end pain and anxiety, travel the right path, and realize nirvana, which is a cessation of suffering. This way is the four establishments of mindfulness. So I'm just kind of repeating that so we remember that the Buddha sets forth mindfulness in a context of transformation. Let me just see, I have two different translations here. The other translation says, monks, there is a direct path for purification of beings, for the surmounting of sorrow and lamentation, for the disappearance of suffering and discontent, for acquiring the true method, for the realization of nirvana, the four satipatthanas, or the four establishments of mindfulness. Okay? So, the Buddha, these four establishments are the body, mindfulness of the body, mindfulness of feelings, which means positive, negative, neutral, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral feelings. It's very simple. Mindfulness of the mind, and then what he calls mindfulness of dhammas. Again, we will go into only, in our talk right now, into the mind. And he says, in regard to the mind, he or she abides contemplating the mind, diligent, clearly knowing, and mindful, free from desires and discontent in the regard of the world. Okay, so even in his introduction of mindfulness of the mind, he gives us kind of a context of how to approach that practice. We have to be clearly knowing. We have to, when we are mindful of the body, when we are mindful of the breath, when we are mindful of the mind, there's clarity. You know, we know what we're doing, right? We clearly know I am mindful of the mind. I am mindful of what's arising in my mind. I am aware of the sensations in my body. This clear knowing, right? And free from desires and discontent in regard to the world. You know all that mental chatter that pulls you away from being mindful? Anybody notice that this morning? Everybody have any perfect, were they perfectly mindful of their body? And the sensations that were rising in their body? Were you all perfectly mindful of your breath and the in and out? Look how simple. Infants do this. And they never heard about Buddhism or mindfulness. They're just present to their breathing. They're present to their whatever going on around them, right? Were we all that? Did we have the capacity of an infant and a child? No, why not? Because we were not free from the desires and discontent in regard to the world. Right? Is that true? Did we not have things on our mind? Did our attention not go to things of the world, our thoughts about the world, our positive negatives about the world, about ourselves, about our bodies? Isn't that true? So the Buddha says, be free when you come to meditate. Come with a clear mind, a mindful mind, free from desires, intent to regard to the world. If we're not free of those, we will find ourselves getting what? Caught up in them. Is that clear? So again, if we just kind of look at the practice of mindfulness of the breath without seeing the context in which we are practicing, we may find ourselves frustrated. Why is this so difficult for me, you know? It's so simple, right? When I'm breathing in, I'm aware that I'm breathing in. When I'm breathing out, I'm aware I'm breathing out. When I get distracted, I know I'm distracted and bring myself back. I mean, is there anything that that you can't understand about that? Right? Simple. Right? Why is it so difficult? Or appears difficult? Because we're not coming to the practice with a mind that is free of its aversions and its attachments to the world. It's always thinking about the world. How the world is going for me. Not going for me, how it's going for the world. Is that clear? So he's giving us instruction in this way. Now, in the section, and there's a lot going on in the sutra in relationship to all these. So, now the Buddha, and hopefully we will be spending some time beginning now, in practicing mindfulness of the mind. Okay. Again, they're just interesting. They're just different ways that these are translation. This is the Thich Nhat Hanh translation. How does a practitioner remain established in the observation of the mind in the mind? When the mind is desiring, the practitioner is aware my mind is desiring. When the mind is not desiring, he or she is aware of my mind is not desiring. When the mind is hating something, angry at something, the practitioner is aware my mind is hating. When it's not hating or it's absent, aware it's not hating. When it's in a state of ignorance, aware that mind is a state of ignorance. When it's not in a state of ignorance, aware that the mind is not. When it's collected, when it's concentrated, aware that it is. When it's not, being aware that it's not. When the mind is distracted, being aware the mind is distracted. When the mind is not distracted, the mind is not. When the mind is vast and wide, when the mind is narrow, constricted, aware. And it goes on like that. Reaching higher, when the mind is composed, when the mind is not composed, when the mind is free, when the mind is not free. There's another in the Chinese canon, it's said a little different. When the practitioner's mind is attached to something, he or she knows it's attached. When it's not attached, knows it's not attached. Hates, not hating. Confused, knows it's confused. Knows when it's not confused. When it's defiled, when it's not defiled. Distracted, not distracted. When the mind has obstacles, it knows it has obstacles. When it has no obstacles, etc. When it's tense, it knows it's tense. When it's not tense, it knows it's not tense. When it's boundless, it knows it's boundless. When it's bound, it knows it's bound. When it's concentrated, it knows it's concentrated. The mind is not liberated, it knows it's not liberated. When it's liberated, it knows So this is very important. Again, there is a context in the Buddha's original instructions about how to be mindful of the mind. First he gives us, as I said earlier, a context in how our mind should be when we approach it. But then when we are aware of our mind, it is in the context of mind states. It's the capacity to be aware of what's going on in my mind right now, what is my mind state right now, and to have a categorization. Usually that categorization, in when you heard, it's this, it's not that, is it wholesome? Is it not wholesome? How many people practice throughout their day? I would even say, how many people, when they were children and went to school or were raised by their parents, you were taught about wholesome minds, unwholesome minds, and how to be taking inventory throughout the day? Did anybody learn that in school? No? Your parents never told you about this practice? No. So this is how we got to where we are today. No one told us that we had a mind. They told us how to fill our mind up with what? Facts, information, right? We went to school and we got lots of information. First we had social studies, then we had English, then we had science and math, right? And it was always giving us what? Information to put into our minds. But no one ever told us about what a mind is and what a wholesome mind and an unwholesome mind is, and wholesome mind states and unwholesome mind states, and how to cultivate and not cultivate. Is that clear? So this is like providing us a piece of very essential information that was skipped over in our education. As if somehow this was not important, right? When it seems like this is most important, because this is the mind that all this information is being put into. This is the mind that's going out into the world and establishing relationships and dealing with things, and right? It's like, what about that mind? You know, are we aware of it? Do we know the difference between what's wholesome and unwholesome? It's like learning, you know, difference between healthy food and unhealthy food for our bodies. Again, most of us didn't grow up in families where anybody knew about that. You just kind of ate the food that people always ate, but there was never a categorization of what foods are really healthy for you and what foods are really not healthy for you. Times have changed in terms of the body, right? There's a lot more awareness these days about what we put into our body has something to do with how our body feels and its health and its longevity and its freedom from illness, right? But this awareness of the mind as a mind, and that the mind states we are cultivating are wholesome and unwholesome, and they affect the state of our mind and well-being of our mind, that is something that is fairly new to us as just a way of being in the world. Is that clear? I mean, does everybody understand this fundamental missing piece of education that we never got? And therefore, we have been what? It's like, again, not knowing anything about healthy food, unhealthy food, nutritious food, junk food. If we didn't know the difference, we would be what? What? Well, we'd be sick. Well, we are sick. But we would be eating what? Junk. Because junk is manufactured in a way to be what? More tasty than nutritious food. Right? And much easier to consume. I mean, it's got like so many good things going for it. Right? But it's essentially junk. Isn't it? We know that now. So we know, but we don't know that in terms of the consumption of our minds and mind states. Right? Right? Now you may have heart issues, stomach issues, you go to cardiologists, you go to the physician, and hopefully they will ask you about your diet, your exercise, and you will learn about, oh, no wonder, you know, I have blood pressure issues, no wonder I have heart issues, right? Maybe it's relating to what I'm putting in my body, see? But oftentimes these days when you go to your mind doctor and you tell them, you know, they give you what? A pill. They don't tell you, oh, it's because you're all day long you're chewing on unwholesome mind states. The opposite is you're not eating, chewing on, cultivating wholesome mind states. So this is so simple and so important. Okay. Please understand that. Don't be fooled by the simplicity and go on to the next page. The Buddha's saying, be mindful of the mind, meaning be mindful of mind states and know them as wholesome and unwholesome. Know them when they're present and know them when they're absent. Right? Know when a healthy mind state, a wholesome mind state is present, and know when it's absent. And when it's absent, what kind of mind state might you be in? Know what is present. But at the same time, when that afflictive or unwholesome mind state is absent, know what that's like. This is very simple, but it's very profound. It can change everything in your life. Right? In the same way that these days when people are learning about things like nutrition and what's healthy and what's unhealthy and, you know, what's good for the body, what's not good for the body, right? They can make, you know, and about exercise and getting enough sleep and, you know, basic how to deal with stress that's in the body and et cetera, right? They can get rid of, just by doing that, significant physical problems. Just by knowing how to take care of the body and do what is wholesome for the body. To have criteria. If you have no criteria and you go shopping, watch out. It's like shopping with a 3-year-old. Practicing mindfulness of the mind means we are aware of our mind. We are aware of the mind state that is present in the mind, and we can put a label on it. And the main label to put on beside the particular is wholesome, unwholesome. Very simple. If we took a vote, how many people would like to have a wholesome mind? Okay. How How many people would like to have an unwholesome mind? Nobody? Well, that's fascinating. Because if I ask the question, how many people here who want a wholesome mind cultivate wholesome mind states throughout their day, how many would raise their hand? Yeah, all day? You're mostly good. And when you cultivate wholesome mind all day, how are you?
Oh, I'm sorry, I thought you were unwholesome.
Oh, I was quite I was quite delighted when you raised your hand. So the question is, of those who voted for a wholesome mind, how many of you are cultivating very consciously all day a wholesome mind state? Please raise your hand. Okay. You do good. How many of you who want to have a wholesome mind find that you maybe spend a good part of your day or some of your day cultivating unwholesome mind states? There you go. Some people put up two hands. Good. All right. This is very important. Can you see? Because cause and effect. I mean, you see, we want a wholesome mind, but really, if I look at my mind all day, I'm really cultivating unwholesome mind states. And yet I think somehow I'm going to end up with a wholesome mind. You see? Cause and effect. It's not going to happen, is it? No matter how much we wish it, no matter how many Dharma books or spiritual books we read, how many days of mindfulness we come to, how many spiritual talks we listen to on the internet, you know, it's not going to happen. Wholesome minds are only created by the cultivation of wholesome mind states and the non-cultivation of unwholesome mind states. I mean, I'm trying to keep it very simple. There is no way in hell, very strong, there is no way in hell that we can create a wholesome mind by cultivating unwholesome mind states. It will never happen. If we cultivate unwholesome mind states, we will have overall an unwholesome mind. And the converse is true too, right? If we want a wholesome mind, if we cultivate wholesome mind states, we will have a wholesome mind. Right? Even if up to this moment you have been very diligently cultivating negative mind states throughout your day and repeating them over and over again throughout your day, right? You can begin the process of transformation today, right? By cultivating more wholesome mind states. And even more importantly, cultivating less unwholesome mind states. Okay, it's a process. It's not like, you know, one day you're going to just turn it on, right? So that can begin today. So those of you in the back who went up two hands about the unwholesome, again, you see, you know, you can begin to change that process today. Just hold on, and then we'll take questions. Okay, but this is the but, and this is why this categorization, at least for me, I'm saying is so important. It gives you criteria. You got to do a little, like if you want to change your diet, eat more healthy, you got to do a little research, right? What is healthy food, right? And what is unhealthy food, right? So you got to know the difference. Especially these days, because the food companies are so ahead of us. You know, they'll put, you know, this is good for you on, Cocoa Puffs or something. You know, because it, I don't know, it's less sugar than. You know what I mean? And so you have to do your own research, don't you? Okay. So you have to know a difference between an unwholesome, a wholesome mind state. That is why there are these lists to kind of get us thinking. Oh. Some of them are obvious, right? The mind of hate. Anybody think that's a wholesome mind state? The mind of anger? How about the mind of irritation and frustration? You see? Well, we might go, well, you know, isn't it justified? All right, can you see? It's subtle, right? The mind of fear, terror, wholesome?
No.
How about the mind of worry? Well, I mean, aren't there things to really worry about? You see? Right. So, we have to be careful. Right. People will say, wow, I really used to eat only terrible foods. Only foods that are no good for me. I used to just live on junk food. Now I eat much healthier, but I still like to indulge myself. Right? We have endless capacity for rationalization and self-justification. We are our own worst enemy. Right? So that's why it's so good that the Buddha goes, wholesome, unwholesome. See, we want middle ground. How about, aren't there many things that are kind of like wholesome, unwholesome, a little bit of each? Wholesome, unwholesome. Right. But he also, as you notice, has other categories like a constricted mind, a bounded mind, a fixated mind, a stuck mind, you see? So there are other ways of just of looking at our mind to see an unwholesome mind state, as opposed to an open mind, a compassionate mind, a free mind, a mind that's at ease, right? So there are mind states that have an emotional, clearly, coloration, but there are many mind states that he talks about that have a very much kind of a feeling tone to them. Judgmental mind, non-judgmental mind. Yeah. Now, so we have to really spend a little time getting to know, one, the practice of mindfulness of the mind, learning to be aware that we have a mind and that there's something going on in it all the time, and that we're able to look, right? We're able to see what's there, and we're able then to categorize in terms of these categories. But at least in the biggest category, if you're not fine-tuning, is wholesome, unwholesome. A wholesome mind is always what? A wholesome mind is always in the service of liberation from suffering. A wholesome mind is always supportive of a calm and clear and open mind. Okay? That's a wholesome mind. An unwholesome mind is anything that's not that. Okay, we're keeping it very simple. This is wholesome. Anything that's not wholesome is unwholesome. So those of you who go, well, you know, I used to really be an anxious person, but now I'm just a worried person. Anybody say, you know, I used to really have a real problem with anger, but now I just get frustrated and irritated a lot. But I'm really not the angry person I used to be. See, we can't get away with that. Wholesome, anything that's not wholesome is unwholesome. Keep it simple. Now, I mean, this is so important because, again, I would say most of us, if we have some commitment to ending our suffering, when we are aware that we're in a mind state or cultivating a mind state that's causing us unwholesomeness, one would think we would then what? Stop. Right? You see? Very simple. We would stop. And if we were checking our minds and we were aware that a mind state has arisen that was positive, that was wholesome, we would what? Continue it. So you don't have to be a great scholar of Buddhist meditation to practice this. Right? It's kind of simple. But it's based on the ability to be aware, mindful of the mind, and to be aware of wholesome, unwholesome mind states. And it has to be, you know, what am I doing in this life? You know, how do I want to show up in this life? How do I want to feel? Has anybody here ever been angry, irritated, frustrated? Okay, how does it feel? How does it feel? Wonderful?
Bad.
Bad. I mean, you see, I mean, in a moment of rationality and self-awareness, we go, yeah, what am I, you know, who is this harming? Is it harming the person you're irritated at? No, they couldn't care less. Right? They don't even know, but I'm saying even if they knew, they'd go, yeah, I'm glad he is. Right? It only harms who? And then it doesn't help. You see, when we have self-awareness and we ask ourselves a simple question, right, is this wholesome? We will probably, unless we're really disturbed, answer, this is not wholesome. This is only harming me. Right? Worry, anxiety, I mean, all these mind states, jealousy, critical mind, I mean, all this stuff, judgmental mind. Wholesome or unwholesome? Just how it feels. Right? Does it ever feel good? No. It's just from the, all these things often feel good just from an ego point of view. Right? These people. Right? But they shape up. And be like who? Be like me. Right? See, it's all ego. See, the ego's getting a little momentary feeling good. But when we stop and go, is this wholesome? Is this really a good feeling when I'm angry? Right? Again, a lot of people love to be angry. Why? Because they feel right. Right? Self-righteous. I'm good, they're bad. Anger. So again, so it's a very powerful practice. Not easy. Not easy to develop that capacity to kind of, I mean, most people don't even have very little self-awareness in our culture. Their moods, their mindsets, just move them this way, blow them this way, blow them that way. Right? But to be able to have self-awareness, to know what's in your mind, and to know whether it's wholesome and unwholesome, and to be on a spiritual path that has committed you to the wholesome, which means the non-cultivation of the unwholesome. We have to understand, they're both. Is that clear? You know, if you're only committed to one and not the other, it's not going to work. We're committed to the wholesome, which means we are ending our commitment to cultivating the unwholesome. When we see we're cultivating the unwholesome, we stop and we do something else. Hopefully something wholesome. So let's talk about this. You had a question, I'm sorry. Yeah, what was your question?
About the middle ground.
About what?
The middle ground.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, can one get to that place?
Like, if there is a place where you are just not doing any of those.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's, see, that's what's behind here.
Okay.
So the question was, wholesome, unwholesome, is there a place where that way we're not working it so hard? Yeah. Yeah. I mean, basically, the deeper one goes, the more one minds one's own natural goodness, one's natural non-selfness, right? The more the natural goodness just comes. And there's less interest in all those afflictive mind states. But those afflictive mind states really, and we're not talking about that today, come from an identification with a separate self. It's always me versus them. But the less one lives life from the world of self and is more living in the world of interconnection and caring about others and all that, there's less affliction will arise. Yeah, but again, it's a process. And to get there, we have to work this one, this wholesome, unwholesome mind states. Okay, does that answer your question? Yeah, good. Are there other questions about the practice of this? The practice of mindfulness of the mind. Wholesome, unwholesome, yes. So the question was, so this is being recorded? Oh, okay, so you're going to be, okay. So the question is, sometimes what happens if you're cultivating a wholesome mind state, not gossiping, not getting angry, and other people around you are going, what's wrong with you, right? Or even getting a little frustrated or angry that you're not frustrated and angry. Well, luckily, you're not practicing for them. You're practicing for you, for your well-being. We're not, as I was saying to somebody yesterday, the fragrant flower gives forth its fragrance just because that is its nature. It doesn't put forth the fragrance because it wants everybody to stop and smell it, right? So, you practice for yourself and you practice to benefit others, even if they don't know it. Right, so if you kind of give up gossip, which is, very prevalent. I mean, many people, when they get together, all they do is talk about other people and often talk about other people in a negative, not very kind way. That's probably not wholesome speech. When you want to kind of not do that because you understand the effects of it, not only on yourself, but you're just perpetuating, yes, you stop. You don't have to put down other people or be critical of other people. You just don't participate. That's fine. What's the problem? Oh. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but we have to, in the teachings on the eight worldly winds, one of the worldly winds is like and dislike, being noticed and being in. And if we are worldly people, that is our object in life. Get as many people to like me as I can, and so therefore I have to live in terror of people disliking me. That is a worldly suffering because you're meeting a worldly need. Now again, is it, if you had a choice, would you like people to like you rather than dislike you? Of course. It feels better to be liked than disliked. But that's not the criteria that we enter life in, because if you enter into life based on wanting to be liked, very fragile, because it's dependent on what? Your happiness is dependent on what? Other people. Very dangerous. Right? Do you like everybody? Do you? No. Right? I mean, do they have a right not to like you? Of course they do. That's just life. You know, we like some, we don't like others. Hopefully we don't hate. I mean, hopefully we don't dislike. But, yeah, we prefer to hang out with certain people and not other people. Right? If we had a choice. So you got to see that the root of that suffering is just the self that wants to be liked. Doesn't want to be disliked. It's not like you go around trying to make people angry at you. But, you know, could that happen? You know, and again, you know, maybe you can talk to people. I mean, it doesn't mean it ends right there, but so what? Is it really that easy? Yes. But if we're attached to the self and wanting to be liked because somehow that gives us an inner sense of happiness or stability, we'll always be unstable. Give it up. Let the world be. Some people, sometimes they'll like you, sometimes they'll dislike you. Right? Isn't that the truth? You know that. And yet the self always has its own kind of sad little agenda, right? It wants to be what? It wants everybody to like it. Doesn't want anybody to dislike it. Always wants to succeed. Never wants, you know, but is everything we do going to be a success? No. You know, sometimes we succeed, sometimes we don't. Sometimes life goes our way, sometimes it doesn't go our way. Right? We know that. And yet, if you want it to only go one way and not go the other way, you will suffer. It's called an afflictive mind state. Unwholesome. We're giving up on wholesomeness. Yes.
But in those situations, did you remove yourself from the situation? You know, I mean, I'm a bit confused because you were saying before, we're not here to be calm, we're here to be uncalm.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're going to be wholesome when we are in this situation, but we are uncomfortable, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now,
mm-hmm.
We are in a situation where we know people don't like us or the way we act, and in a way we okay, that's okay. They have the right to feel that way.
Mm-hmm.
The same way I do too. Mm-hmm. But yet, you know, it's like, what could you do? You move away from the situation and you find other situations when you practice.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's a good question. So the question is, so you're saying, it's sort of like, so practically, what do? Again, right. So it is the, you know, again, these teachings are about the inner life of each of us, right? How are we within our own mind, right? How do we cultivate wholesome unwholesomeness in our own mind? How do we cultivate mindfulness? So this is the important thing, right? That we're, you know, that there's some inner life here. There's somebody here who's aware, right? And then, you know, unless we live alone or something, you know, we enter the world and, like you say, so what happens if you're in a situation where everybody's gossiping? All right, blah, 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 you know, it's all negative. All right, so, you know, what do? I don't know. I mean, it depends on what you, the freedom you have. Sometimes you just are there and you stay silent. You're not going to contribute to any more of that. But you don't, you know, that's all. Sometimes if you have the freedom, you may choose not to hang out with those people. You have that freedom too. Not because they're bad people, but just because what they do is unwholesome and they don't know any better. I mean, it's not like that you keep putting yourself into difficult situations so you can cultivate, being comfortable with uncomfortableness, you know. I think if you just live life, you'll have enough of that. You don't have to go out of your way. Yeah, but, you know, again, it depends on the situation. You know, sometimes we have freedom to make choices, but sometimes we don't. You know, we're kind of stuck with it for whatever reason. We're stuck with these people, stuck with this work, stuck with this society, right? Stuck with this world. What do? We have to, then we have to, yeah, find the peace within. Yeah, thank you. Yes, and were there? Yes.
In many situations where I've been uncomfortable, my daughter told me to, suggested to me to say, to be able to say something to the people who were doing whatever it was that was making this thing that I didn't want to participate in. She suggested to say, I'm sorry, that makes me uncomfortable. Can you not do that? Or something like that. I'm just, is that...
Again, I mean, these are, everything is situational, so it's hard to say. It depends on the situation, the people, your own comfort level. You know, I mean, like we're saying back here, some situations, you know, nobody's open, nobody's interested. to kind of make some statement about your uncomfortability, like, could just make, you know, make it even get worse. So I think everything is the appropriateness of the situation, and then, you know, how would I act skillfully? If they're, you know, I mean, sometimes, I mean, I remember when I used to work, you know, and if there's any place that has a lot of negative gossip, it's the workplace lunchroom. I don't know if it's changed, but, you know, I mean, like, you know, people are talking about this person. Then the person comes in, and they start talking about somebody else, and they leave. They're probably talking about you when you leave, you know, right? Again, you know, rather than getting up on the soapbox and, you know, making a sermon about wholesome and unwholesome mind states, again, you could not participate. What I used to do is say something positive about the person who people are all talking negatively about. Again, you know, doing my best to maybe change the context a little bit. Right? Or just, you know, finishing up my lunch and leaving early. You know, just because it's not interesting, you know, rather be somewhere else. So again, it just depends on the situation, but...
I guess you have to practice it.
Yeah, you have to practice it. So you're more comfortable being yourself and speaking. You know, like you said, people may not always be happy with you.
If you're saying you come to a meal and you realize that there's nothing
So again, you have to understand, right, you do your best not to offend people, right? So if you're a vegetarian and you're going to eat with somebody's home who's a non-vegetarian, you might let them know in advance you're a vegetarian, right? It's one way of handling it. You haven't done that, or you did do that and they don't get it, so you get there and... I don't know, it's just roast pork, you know, just barbecue, and that's all there is, a little bacon on the side. You know, you may have to say, thank you very much, but I'm a vegetarian, and I'm, you know, I don't, but that's fine. You know, but you always, you know, I'm fine. Don't worry about me. You know, and then people may respond to that depending on who they are. But again, that's where you got to decide how. You know, if this is your values and this is the way you live, then you can't expect the world to go along with you. See, that's kind of egocentric, isn't it?
I think it was more speaking to, I guess, what you're talking about is allowing myself to be a little uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Because that's what my value is, and that's okay.
Right. I mean, to understand that if you live in a world that you have values that you live by, and they are meaningful to you, that not everybody you encounter is gonna be happy about that. Some people may be unhappy about that. And that just, that's okay, isn't it? Right, well, as somebody was just saying, you got to practice it. You got to take it into the world. So you're comfortable. You're always at ease. It's not dependent on whether they like you or don't like you. It doesn't depend on whether it's going your way or not going your way. As long as that's where we're caught up, you know, well, our minds will always be up and down. But you want to live from a deeper place within.